Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, pulls it apart and weaves the facts back together in a way that's easy to understand. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This season, we're untangling caregiving in Ohio. One of the hardest decisions caregivers make is whether to move their loved one into a facility. But the difficulty doesn't end there. In fact, it's often just getting started. From assisted living to nursing homes to memory care facilities, the options can seem endless. And so can the costs. Here to help us navigate care outside of the home is Howard Gleckman, the senior fellow at the Urban Institute, where he works on tax and retirement policies. He's also the author of the book, Caring for Our Parents. Howard, welcome to Untangled.
Hi, Amy. Good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. And so you wrote your book, Caring for Our Parents, after you found yourself suddenly thrust into the long-term care system to help a family member. What did you discover at that time about America's elder care system?
Well, what I discovered was that it was terrifying and that it was completely fragmented and chaotic. It lives in a language all its own that most normal humans don't understand. It's entirely separated from medical care in most cases. It's expensive, as you said, and a mistake can be literally catastrophic, can kill a parent.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned that the costs are crushing, and an already fragile system is going to struggle even more and more as more people live to their 80s and beyond. So in the years since you wrote your book, do you think things have gotten worse or better?
They've gotten worse. More and more people have gotten old because of the baby boomers. And the system is not in any way prepared to manage those aging people.
Now, you mentioned that it's confusing because it's not considered medical care. So meaning if you're on Medicare and you have Medicare for insurance or you have private insurance, that only covers medical issues you have, but needing to live in an assisted living facility, that's not considered medical care?
That's right. I think the biggest misconception that most people have is they think that Medicare or Medicare supplement or Medigap insurance will pay for their long-term care. It will not. There are a few minor exceptions, but for the most part, it won't. And if you're living in assisted living, often even Medicaid won't pay. Medicaid is available to pay for people if you're poor enough and if you have insufficient income. But Medicaid generally pays only for nursing homes and only under limited circumstances for assisted living.
Right. So we can get more into those costs as we continue to talk. But let's talk about some of the different options when it comes to facilities. So, you know, the one that you think of first and foremost is a nursing home. So, but and that's different than assisted living and all of these other kind of facilities. How are they set apart?
So at least we understand what nursing homes are. The federal government regulates nursing homes. There's strange kinds of creatures because they have two different kinds of businesses in the same building. They have what's called post-acute care, skilled nursing. That's for example, what happens, you fall and you've broken a hip, you get your hip repaired in the hospital, and now you need rehab and you go to a nursing home for that. So there's that. Medicare does pay for that.
So if it's rehab, like from like a medical related issue, if it's rehab, then Medicare will pay for it.
That's correct. Okay. But in the same building, there's often what they call long stay, which is the where people will go to live for the rest of their lives. That's where Medicaid pays, not Medicare. Medicaid pays if you're poor enough, or you can pay privately, or if you have long-term care insurance, it will pay. You know, that's generally going to cost, I actually looked it up in Ohio, it's going to cost on average about $9,000 a month, which is way beyond what most people can afford. Yeah, $9,000 a month, which $110,000 or $120,000 a year, much more than most people can afford to pay. At least, though, we know what it is. It's regulated by the federal government. It operates under a tremendous number of highly technical rules, which can be good and can be bad. It's an interesting contrast with assisted living, where there is no definition. Assisted living is where people who need help live that isn't a nursing home. Every state has a different definition of assisted living. Some states regulate them quite heavily, some states don't regulate them very much at all. Then there's memory care, which is kind of a subset of assisted living. And memory care is, as you would imagine, it's care for people who are living with dementia, Alzheimer's disease, or other dementias. And it's the same thing. It's regulated heavily in some states and not at all in others. In some facilities, it's a locked unit. You can't really leave the hallway that you live in. In others, people are much more flexible. In some states, aides have to have specific training for caring for people with dementia. In other states, they don't. Assisted living is generally regulated by the state entirely and not at all by the federal government. Definition is entirely dependent on the state. So it's a whole different world. And then there are what they call continuing care retirement communities, or CCRCs, or sometimes called life plan communities. And what they attempt to do is combine independent living, assisted living, and sometimes nursing care on one campus. They operate under a number of different models, but a typical sort of model is you pay an entrance fee, which may be a few hundred thousand dollars, and then you pay a monthly fee for independent living. And then in some of the facilities, if you need more care, you pay a little more every month. And if you need more care, you pay even more. In others, you pay the flat fee and you get the care, whether you're an assisted, independent, or in nursing. So many different models, but that's another way to look at this.
So how does a nursing home get decided that it's a nursing home as opposed to an assisted living facility?
Because it is licensed by the federal government as a nursing home.
Okay.
And it so a way to think about it is this. If you're in an independent living, in senior independent living, you get no assistance. You may have congregate meals. You know, everybody gets together in the dining room. There may be, social events, lectures, movies, trips to the ball game or the theater or something like that. But you don't get any personal care if you're living in independent living. If you're living in assisted living, you do get some level of personal care. Not a lot, but some. And generally, the way assisted living works is it's organized in tiers. So tier one assisted living, you get very little care. Tier four assisted living, you get significantly more care. And of course, for each tier, you pay more. When you get to tier four, you're starting to get an amount of care that begins to approach what you get in the nursing home. But there may not be a nurse. There may just be aides who are providing that level of care. And the reality is, for most people, aides are all they need, but sometimes, something will happen and you need a nurse. And in assisted living, there may not be one. When you get to a nursing home, there are nurses, but the nurses may not be there all the time. They may not be there on nights. They may not be there on weekends. The Biden administration actually proposed regulations that required a nurse to be in a nursing home 24/7. But the industry has sued the Biden administration. And I suspect what's going to happen is the Trump administration will just abandon that regulation. So, strange as it may seem, you can live in a nursing home and there may not actually be the care of a registered nurse depending on the time of day or the day of the week.
This is Untangled from All Sides, and this hour we're talking about the costs of long-term care. With us is Howard Gleckman, Senior Fellow at the Urban Institute, where he works on tax and retirement policy. He's also the author of the book Caring for Our Parents. So the if you have the luxury of time, where meaning that it's not a sudden fall or dad had a stroke and you need to find a place as soon as possible, if you have the luxury of time, what do you recommend doing when trying to decide what you're going to need?
So the first thing is, if you have the luxury of time, it's a great way to ask the question because most of the time we don't. We wait until the crisis, everything has now hit the fan, and we're in a panic and we just do something. But if you have the luxury of time, which you should, the first thing I recommend is if you're an adult child, don't do this yourself. Bring your parents into the decision making. That's where they're going to live. And to the degree they can, let them decide. So visit a number of places. Talk to the residents. Leave the marketing person in her office. Don't let her follow you around. Just talk to residents, talk to the staff, and ask them what it's like. In some places, in some continuing care communities, in some senior living communities, you can actually stay there for a couple of days. They may have a room where you could stay, like, as if it were a hotel, And you could join people for meals and get a sense of what it really is like to live there. One of the things that's very important in senior living and even in assisted living is what's the rest of the community like? Often what'll happen is people will congregate kind of depending on their own interests. So there may be facilities, for example, where there are lots of military retirees. If you're a retired colonel, that may be the perfect place for you. But if you're somebody who, went to anti-war demonstrations when you were a kid, that may not be the place you want to go. Other places are faith-based, and you may want to go to a place if it's important to you that where many of the people there are the same religion you are. So, get a sense of what the culture of the place is. And then, of course, there is the cost. You may look at a place and it seems terrific and you just can't afford it. The other thing is there is in senior living a phrase known as buying the lobby. And what often happens is, you go into the lobby of one of these places and you see the wood paneled walls and the beautiful flowers and the nice furniture. And that is all there so that the adult children don't feel so guilty about moving their parents into the facility. But what you want to do is you want to get past the lobby and you want to see what the rooms are like. You want to see what the people are like. You want to see what the staff is like.
I mean, later in the hour, we're going to talk to an attorney about planning things and planning out the money. But we've mentioned money quite a few times, and you've used the phrase, if you can afford it, if you can afford it. So, I mean, this seems very expensive. So, is the way that a lot of people afford it is that they planned whenever they were younger to have the money in their retirement, or it's from selling their house and they have this big chunk of money to use? Is that the way a lot of people pay for it?
Oh, Amy, I wish people planned, but they don't. Very few people plan for it. When they think about planning for retirement, they're thinking about golf and they're thinking about cruises. They're not thinking about long-term care. Some people have purchased insurance, not very many, frankly, but there are some people who do have long-term care insurance. Selling your house is certainly a way to do it, or taking out a loan on your house is another way to do it. But it's very expensive. And to your listeners who are in their 40s, I would beg you plan for this. The research that we've done at the Urban Institute says that about 50%, 55% of people over age 65 are going to need some long-term care before they die. And men are going to need it for an average of about 2 years, and women are going to need it for an average of about 3 years. So do the math, figure out how much you're going to need to pay for that kind of care. Often what happens is people say, I don't want to sell my house. I want to save it for my children. But the reality is the kids don't really want the house. So you've got to think about this, and you've got to also communicate with your family. This is not a secret. This should be a family operation. Everybody should work together. The adult kids should be on the same page as their parents. And it really is true. Let your parents, to the degree they can, make the decision themselves.
You've mentioned long-term care insurance a couple of times. I'm guessing that's something that you need to buy in your 40s, not in your 60s.
Yeah, you should, if you're going to buy it, you should buy it in your 40s or 50s at the latest. There are a couple of problems with waiting until your 60s. One of them is it gets really expensive. Typically now for a couple, $3,000 a month is not unusual.
For the insurance premium.
For the premium, for insurance premiums, it's a lot of money. The other problem is that insurance companies underwrite very strictly now. So if you have a pre-existing condition or if you have a family medical history that they don't like, they can reject you. So it makes it even harder to buy. The problem is that people in their 40s have other things to do. They may still be paying off their own college loans. They may be thinking about saving for their kids' college. They're paying a mortgage. They're paying for health insurance. They're paying for auto insurance. So there's all sorts of things going on in people's lives that distract them from thinking about their old age. Chances are you're not going to need long-term care insurance until you're 80. So getting people to think in their 40s about a risk that they're going to have 40 years from now is really hard. But it would be nice if people did think about it and begin to put some money away for their old age.
And this, the last thing I wanted to ask you about is this idea of when Medicaid kicks in. So basically, Medicaid will help pay for long-term care after you run out of money. Is that right?
That's right. You've got to be broke. It varies from state to state, but typically if you have more than $2,000 in financial assets, you're not eligible.
$2,000.
$2,000 in financial assets. The $2,000 money in the bank and brokerage accounts in certain kinds of insurance in some states and retirement accounts. So it's almost nobody. Most of the people who qualify for Medicaid, long-term care in old age, are people who were poor their whole lives. You'll often hear people, some critics of Medicaid who will say, there's all this fraud going on. There are all these, rich people who are artificially spending down their assets so they can qualify for Medicaid. There's two problems with that. First of all, the data don't support that. As they say, most people who qualify for Medicaid long-term care have been poor all their lives. The other problem is, why would you want to qualify for Medicaid if you had a lot of money? Medicaid often means, for example, if you're living in a nursing home, you're sharing a room with a stranger. Why would you want to do that? So it happens. There are lawyers who will do this, who will create trusts for you and other tools that allow you to spend down and go on to Medicaid. But most people don't, and most people wouldn't want to.
That was Howard Gleckman, senior fellow at the Urban Institute, where he works on tax and retirement policies. Howard, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we're going to talk about navigating the decision to allow a loved one to age in place, stay in their home, rather than move to a facility. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WOSU comes from listeners. You can give at WOSU.org. Support also comes from the cancer experts at Ohio Health, delivering care that empowers patients to keep making plans. Learn more at ohiohealth.com/keepmakingplans.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This season, we're untangling caregiving in Ohio. One of the hardest decisions caregivers make is whether to keep their loved one at home or send them somewhere else. Lisa Von Lemden is the executive director of the Ohio Council for Home Care and Hospice. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Amy.
So Lisa has spent 20 years helping people navigate these decisions, and she's joining us now. You started in the field the way many caregiver advocates do. You had a family member who was suddenly in need of help. Can you tell us that story?
I actually started in home health back in 2004, wanting to get into pharmaceutical sales. But I needed a job where I could kind of dip my toe in the water with medical sales and whatnot. So I took a job with a home health care agency out of Lakewood, Ohio, actually. And it was there that I really had my first taste of home health. Kind of a funny story. I was sitting in a room with a ton of the nurses, and we were all talking about PT and OT. And I was so green in this industry. I was literally like, I don't want to work part-time or overtime. I just want a full-time job, 40 hours a week. Didn't realize that they were talking about physical and occupational therapy. But that was the turning moment in my career where I said, I represent the adult daughter and the granddaughters of the folks that we are all taking care of. And we don't understand some of this jargon, especially when you're coming into our homes. So it was actually there that I got my start. Unfortunately, several years thereafter, I did have my godfather fall ill with ALS. And that just continued to catapult my passion for being able to provide care in the home.
Yeah. So the idea of with your organization, the idea is to help people stay in their homes, right? Rather than moving to, in the first segment, we were talking about the different versions of long-term care. But another version of long-term care is to stay in your house and get help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And oftentimes, you know, I was listening to Mr. Gleckman and he had some really great information in regards to how to select, you know, a facility, if you will, or what it looks like to make those decisions. I think the decision to stay in your home is a really personal decision that not only should be made by the patient, but also the caregivers, because care really becomes everybody's responsibility at that point. You know, when you start to think about having a family, right, you and your spouse would sit down and talk about, can one of us stay at home to raise the children? Do we both need to work? If so, are we bringing somebody in the home? Are we going out of the home to daycare? Sort of the same way when you talk about caring for a loved one, especially an aging loved one. And I think it's a really personal decision. But there are so many different levels of home health care that can be provided. And there's quite a few different options out there. So really, the sooner you can start to look at, what does mom want as she ages? What would dad like to do? He's healthy today. But, you know, we really should have a plan for this. Home health is a really great option, though. It's a very intimate option and one that's extremely rewarding.
So let's talk about the different levels of home health care. I mean, the first thing that you think about is probably assessing your house, right? Are the bathrooms all you have to go upstairs or downstairs to get to a bathroom? So do you talk to people about living in a place where they can age?
Certainly. And actually, occupational therapy, that's one of their biggest goals when they're going into the home, is to do that home safety evaluation. Is this even an option? Mm. You may want to choose this, but what are the modifications to the home going to look like? What's that cost going to look like? Is it covered by a long-term care insurance, or is that going to come out of pocket? But we have professionals on staff that can walk into the home and quickly kind of take a look and say, yes, this home is suitable for somebody to age in place, or nope, we're going to have to make these modifications in order to be able to keep you here safely.
And so then there's other levels of in-home care as to whether you're going to have a family member help you out, or if you need someone to come into your home, someone who is not a family member.
Sure. So in-home care, I want you to kind of think of it like maybe three or four different levels of care, so to speak. You have your Medicare certified care, or your skilled care. This is where a doctor is placing an order, kind of like a prescription, if you will, of what kind of care should be provided. So nursing, PT, OT, social work, home health aides all fall under this. And it's typically covered by Medicare Part A at 100% or a Medicare Advantage plan.
So that's a doctor has prescribed, I'm using air quotes, but prescribed to you that you need help.
Yes.
Right. And then Medicare will cover it.
Yes. Okay. You need to be homebound. Mm. So your trips out are of short duration. They require assistance. You need to have a skill that requires the care of a licensed professional, nursing, therapy. Mm. And then you need to have the doctor's order. And people need to understand, and this is really important, because I feel like most of our patients and clients are really disappointed when they find out that this is not forever care. Mm. This is skilled intermittent care. We are coming in. We are doing an admission on you. We are coming up with your goals. And then once we meet goals, we're out. Right. And at that point, then you need to look at, can you continue to maintain independence, or do you need to go into a different level of home health care, which oftentimes can be covered by, let's say, the Ohio Department of Aging, our passport services, or our state plans, private duty nursing, all covered by the Ohio Department of Medicaid and the Department of Aging, if you qualify. Mm. And then lastly, we have private duty. That's where, much like a babysitter, you know, you're seeking out an organization that can provide a caregiver. And in your, I like to say you're calling the shots, right? Mm-hmm. You make the rules when you're buying private duty care, because you're actually paying for it out of pocket.
So Ohio has a waiting list for in-home health aides. Correct? It's a big list. Tell me about the list.
So it shrunk quite a bit. You know, thanks to the state of Ohio in our last budget, you know, home and community-based services saw the largest increase in Medicaid dollars since 1998. If you would have asked me this question 2 years ago, I could have wrapped stats in regards to over 5,000 Ohioans at home needing passport services, couldn't find home health aides. Now today, as a result of that budget increase, we've actually been able to pay our home health aides more. So we've been, I would say, a lot more aggressive with what our compensation packages look like. And the result is that more Ohioans are receiving care. So what the state did actually work. We took our home health aides from an average of about $11 an hour up to $15 to $16 an hour, and that made quite a bit of difference. But the work's not done. Mm-hmm. We still do have Ohioans that are in need of care. We still have waiting list. They've just gone down significantly.
Now, we're going to talk to a lawyer in the next segment about what people can do with their assets in regard to being able to pay for in-home care or long-term care in a facility. But you mentioned getting help from Medicaid and the state to pay for this, but you can only use it if you have no money. Is that correct?
That's correct. You have to qualify for Medicaid, which means you need to be under a certain threshold of income to be able to receive services under the Ohio Department of Medicaid. The Ohio Department of Aging does have, I would say, a little more leniency with what they do with the passport services. But the very first line item is you still have to be Medicaid eligible to receive those services. So
You mentioned the passport services a couple of times. Can you tell what are passport services? What does that mean? That we're using the word passport.
Yeah. So that's
You're not going to the Bahamas. Yet.
Nope. Unfortunately, that is a program put on by the Ohio Department of Aging for patients that are 60 years old or older. A caseworker would come out and assess your situation, and it's typically for patients who are aging that would typically qualify for let's say skilled nursing facility or long-term care facility services, but with certain help in the home for a certain number of hours per week, we can actually keep them in their home, which is a more cost-effective level of care. So passport services are provided under the Ohio Department of Aging, which, as we know, is a department under the Ohio Department of Medicaid, so ultimately funded by Medicaid, but governed by the Ohio Department of Aging. And it is a great solution for folks in Ohio that are Medicaid eligible and do just need a little extra help to be able to stay in their homes.
This is Untangled Caregiving from All Sides, and we're talking with Lisa Von Lenden, the Executive Director of the Ohio Council for Home Care and Hospice. So do you speak to a lot of people who are passionate about staying in their home? Is that the goal for a lot of people, is just to stay in their home as long as possible?
It is. I think it always has been. I mean, if you think about it, where do you want to be when you're ill? Mm-hmm. You want to be at home in your own bed. You know, when you go to the hospitals, nurses are coming in and out of your room every 15 minutes, every hour, doing blood pressure checks and whatnot. I do believe that people would prefer to stay in their home. And I think the pandemic actually catapulted that, because the unfortunate fact of the matter is the facilities got a little bit of a bad rap there around the pandemic with, you know, families not being able to come in and visit their loved ones. There is a right level of care for everyone everywhere. It really just depends on the assistance, the family and friends that you have around you, and then also, you know, the level of care that you need. If you can stay in your home, it's certainly much more comfortable. You know, I mean, we as home care owner operators and care delivery clinicians, it's one of the most intimate settings of care you can ever be in. I mean, if you think about it, there are no staffing ratios. You are walking into somebody's private home, invited, and you are providing one-on-one care with that person. I mean, you in essence can become like extended family. And you know, you also love like extended family. I mean, we're everybody's granddaughter and daughter when we get into the homes. So I think that if people had the choice, I believe that they probably would want to stay in their homes. It's just that some people, unfortunately, are so sick and so declined that it just simply might not be the right level of care.
Now, I know that I'm guessing that everyone's cost is different, right? Because everyone needs a different level of care. You could have someone stop by once a day for an hour, or you can have someone who's there for 8 hours, right? So is there an average cost to in-home care?
So the actual average cost, if you were to purchase in-home care for the home health aide, if you will, like through private duty, like we had talked about, is typically between about $25 upwards of $30 or more per hour. That adds up quick. You know, and we're aware of that, right? Especially if you have a loved one who needs 12 plus hours of care per day, either because the family's working outside of the home and simply can't be there, or because there's a dignity issue. Mm. You know, that is one thing that we oftentimes have to look at with our aging population, right? Are you okay with your son or daughter being able to perform some of the services that they're going to need to perform on you to be able to keep you here in the home? And, you know, if you have access to the money, a lot of families will lean into the idea of private duty so that they can keep that level of dignity. But the unfortunate fact of the matter is it's not a one-size-fits-all. I could not come on this show and say to you, this is what it's going to cost to keep your loved one in the home, because it has to do with a myriad of different factors that each person has individually.
Right, right. And if you are, you know, a son, a child, son, daughter, niece, nephew, and you want to help take care of a loved one, you just have to do that of your own kindness, or you have to quit. Some people quit their jobs. Some people keep working and, you know, pop in and out. Tell me about that.
Certainly. So there are different programs coming out, structured family caregiving, self-directed care, where patients would have the ability to, let's say, select a friend or a family member to be able to provide that care. It's a different program. They're new programs. Some of them are not quite off the ground yet in the state of Ohio. We've got neighboring states, I believe, that may have adopted some of them. But it's definitely a program that the Ohio Council is looking into and supporting. Because at the end of the day, I oftentimes tell people what we're really facing as a workforce is, I'll say it like this, Sarah, Kara, and Tara are all 18 years old. They have their whole lives ahead of them, right? Tara's going to go off to college. She wants to become a doctor, right? And Sarah, I don't know, maybe she's into Instagram and she thinks she's going to become an influencer. Mm-hmm. Kara, on the other hand, has no choice. Her mom has MS. She's declining. She's living in the home. They can't afford to find care outside of the family. Kara's fate is set. She's going to become a home health aide, possibly go to school at community college to get her nursing degree so that she can make some more money. But that's the reality, right? And I think we're seeing this more and more. Our nursing schools aren't as full as they used to be. We don't have as many individuals coming into care as we did back in the day, and our baby boomers are aging out. So as the baby boomers come out of the workforce and need care, we simply don't have enough people coming into it. So we're going to have to lean into family members. We're going to have to lean into self-direction where you can find a neighbor or a friend or a family member to come in and help provide that care, because we simply just don't have enough access to workforce right now.
The last thing I wanted to ask you is related to that. As the population ages, there's concerns that Ohio won't be able to meet the increasing demand. What are you hoping to see, whether it's from state lawmakers, federal money? What do we need as we more and more people live past 80?
Well, that's a great question. And I feel like I'm going to give you a really political answer here. Mm-hmm. But in home health care, we oftentimes say we can't hire nurses straight out of college. Why? Because they don't have their clinical decision-making skills up to snuff, right? I mean, you typically would go into the hospitals, work the floors, and really become a good nurse before you would go into home health. Because at the end of the day, in home health, no one is looking over your shoulder. Mm-hmm. There's not a team of clinicians and doctors to yell down to ask, hey, what are we going to do about this? So the Ohio Council has actually asked the state of Ohio to invest dollars into workforce development programs so that we can start talking with nursing students while they're still in school, take them onto clinical rotations, possibly give them internships, maybe externships, but most importantly, post-graduation after passing the NCLEX, have them provided a mentor. So that we can really learn about home health and hospice and what it is to provide care in those alternative types of environments. You know, the idea is if we're projecting that people are going to want to stay in their home, and we're projecting that individuals are going to be able to continue to receive care in the home, even at higher acuities, we have to then invest in that workforce and make sure that they're prepared to deliver care in the home. So am I nervous about it? Sure. I mean, we're seeing it right now. People are going home from the hospital without home health, even though it was ordered, because we just don't have enough clinicians to be able to take on the cases. So I think we need to invest into the education and the experience and really continue to show clinicians what home and community-based services is all about.
That was Lisa Von Lemden, the executive director of the Ohio Council for Home Care and Hospice. Thanks for being here, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk with an attorney about protecting your assets as you head into your elder care system. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. This season, we're untangling caregiving in Ohio. We're looking at how to provide the best possible care for our loved ones as they age, and whether they can stay in their homes or need to move to a nursing facility. One of the many concerns about moving to a care facility is doing so in a way that won't break the bank and allows you to protect your assets. We're joined now by Jeff Kunkler, the family wealth and estate planning attorney with Carlisle Patchen and Murphy Law Firm. His primary practice is with family wealth and estate planning. Welcome to All Sides, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
So you described yourself as a quarterback on relationships where you help people establish their estate plan. So what do you do for people?
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it and a great question. So many people, as we're particularly in the space of long-term care and elder law, we're trying to figure out, you know, who cares for mom and dad, who makes their decisions. There's going to be a team involved, and that's probably going to include a financial professional. You may have tax advisors. You may have someone like myself, an attorney, but you're also going to have more boots on the ground, your caregivers, perhaps care coordinators and whatnot. Many people don't know where to start, and so they come to someone like me saying, you know, I'm either aging or perhaps my parents are aging. How do I navigate this in advance? And ideally, you would plan in advance to get some documents and tools in place, and they're going to ask us, you know, how do I line up in home care or pick a facility? And we may not be, as a lawyer, the right person to necessarily do some of those tasks, but because we're in this space, I often give out referrals or connections to those other sorts of things. And so that makes me sort of that quarterback where they come to me and they call with this. Well, the reality is that's not a service I provide, but I do know good caregivers, good providers, and can help connect to you.
So when do you recommend people seriously begin talking about this, estate planning?
A few natural intervals. Certainly younger folks, as soon as you're an adult, technically, you should have some documents in place. I don't have a lot of 18-year-olds who are, I just graduated high school and I'm ready to sign a will and a power of attorney. But should they have some documents? Absolutely. Every adult ought to have some decision makers lined up if they're in an accident or pass away. The more natural intervals are, I've started a family or had kids, is a good time to do a basic plan. Certainly, as you're getting a little older and your kids are becoming grown, it's a good time to revisit. And then for this series that you guys are working on, it's really more I'm at or approaching retirement or perhaps just beyond it, and I want to see if what I've done is going to be sufficient to accomplish my goals, whether that's care-related, inheritance, taxes, et cetera. And so right around that 5 years before and after retirement tends to be a pretty good time when you still have the finances, perhaps the cognitive ability to make some important decisions.
Now, a lot of people end up getting thrown into the situation. There's a, you know, mom or dad have a sudden fall. There's a stroke. It's an emergency. Do you see people in emergencies having to grapple with these things and not knowing where mom and dad's money is?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, that's probably as often, if not more often, than the proactive call. I give a lot of talks and sort of classes on these subjects, and I always describe it in two buckets. There's proactive planning. We would rather be proactive, say in advance, when I have that fall, call this son or daughter. If I need my money managed, call this other person. The reality is that doesn't always happen. And we do get a lot of calls that some crisis has come up. There's been an accident, a fall, a particular diagnosis of perhaps a cognitive issue. And now we're in reactive mode, making the best of what we can. the best plan would have been done in advance and give us those answers. If it's not done, well, then that's just the reality and you have to plan accordingly. But yes, that call happens all the time where people thought they were taken care of and then they had that fall and you sort of test the plan and realize, oops, we're missing something or need to make a pivot.
Now, when it's a fall or a sudden stroke like that, a lot of people who have Medicare, that'll kick in and that'll pay because it's medical related. It's the care afterwards. So you're better, but maybe you can't get around your house as well as you used to. Is that whenever they come to you and they're saying, we need to decide what to do with the house?
Absolutely. So yes, that your other guests in this series have talked about it, but ideally your rehab stay. I've had a fall, I had a hip replacement, and I'm needing some rehab, should be covered by Medicare for up to 100 days. There's some check-ins along the way. But yes, the short stay is supposed to get you back on your feet through the Medicare that you're already paying for through Social Security, end up back at your house. The reality is sometimes that fall, that's not realistic. By the time you run out of care that's covered by Medicare, you're home without enough support and help. And so you're either going to have a family member step in or privately hire someone, or perhaps you're realizing this is more permanent. I'm not suited to come back to this home, either due to my new and changed health condition, or maybe this house was never well suited for someone who is aging. And so then it becomes, do we fix up the house? Do we start looking at facilities? If this house doesn't fit, then yeah, how do we sell it? And for a lot of people, how do I preserve what I've paid off? The equity in this house is one of my biggest assets. How do I preserve that becomes an important question.
All right. This is Untangled from All Sides, and we're talking about caregiving. This hour, we're talking about how to plan it for it and pay for it with Jeff Kunkler, a family wealth and estate planning attorney with Carlisle, Patchen & Murphy. So you just mentioned your equity in your home. This care is very expensive. Our first guest mentioned $9,000 a month sometimes. Every bit of it is a different amount of money. How do you have people approach what they do with their retirement savings, with the equity they have in their home? Does everyone have a different opinion of how they want to spend their money?
Absolutely. Every single person has a different opinion of that. The consensus is generally, I want to give the fewest number of dollars possible to certain groups. The IRS is on top of that list usually. And often a care facility or something along those lines, I'd rather not pay them and get more money to my kids, my grandkids, my church, my charity, some cause like that. And so those themes tend to ring true for almost everyone, that I've worked for this and I thought this was going to help my grandkids pay for school someday. I didn't think I'd be paying that $9,000 a month facility. And the reality is, if I multiply that 9,000 enough times, I'm going to run out. And that's not what I wanted to have happen. So absolutely, that becomes an important question.
So what do you tell people to do?
Yeah, there are three main categories of options, and some of this depends, are we on the proactive side or the reactive side? Mm-hmm. Certainly one option, and your first guest described it nicely, is to do what I call private pay. If you have the funds and are able to, you can pick any facility you'd like to go to, absent some wait lists and constraints like that. But generally, if you want in-home care and you can afford it, pay for it. If you want to go to a certain private facility and you can pay for it, you can do that. That tends to be the easiest in that you don't have to purchase any insurance policies or set up any trusts with me or anything. The downside is it's coming out of your pocket. So not everyone has the financial means to be able to write that check on an ongoing basis. But certainly if you can, self-insurance, take the risk upon yourself is one option. Sort of door number two would be looking to some sort of financial planning or insurance tool.
Okay.
I don't sell any of those things, but there are lots of good providers who do. And I know your other guests have talked about this as well. Not a lot of people carry long-term insurance, but if someone walks in and says, I'm trying to figure out how to pay for an assisted living or a nursing home, and I do in fact have an insurance policy in place, that's wonderful. Let's see what that policy covers. Is it going to cover 100% of your cost or more often a portion? And would that portion combined with your financials allow you to get the care? So that's sort of door number two. And the door number three would be look into some sort of government benefit program. Medicaid's certainly a big one. Veterans benefits might help out as well. Those programs have an incredible divergence in sort of way you might end up on them. If you're poor, to the first person's who you talked to today's point, you might be able to just apply and get on Medicaid if you don't have the financial resources and you meet their limits. Other people need to structure things and get stuff out of their name, either way in advance or perhaps at the time of need to qualify for either Medicaid or veterans benefits.
Yeah, let's talk about that portion of getting something out of your name to qualify for Medicaid. Because I've heard people say that they wanted to gift their house to their children, and that was always the plan. But then they ended up in a nursing home sooner than they thought. Can you talk to me about that gap of what of when it's your asset and if you gifted it to your children?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of nuance to this. And as a lawyer, it depends is the start of every answer. And it does depend on the individual circumstance. But as a general rule, if we're talking about a single person, because that's a little easier from understanding the benefit standpoint, if you were had your fall today and needed to go to a nursing home today, what the application asks is what's in your name today. And as stated earlier, you can have $2,000 total. And what have you done for the last 5 years? That gets to this magic term people have probably heard of called the 5-year look back, which is sort of your timing window. If you could say more than 5 years ago, I did do what I've described. I have given my house away. Now, there's some risks with that, and I wouldn't necessarily advise people go start giving their house away tomorrow. But with proper planning, there are ways people could start that 5-year clock. The key is it's a 5-year window. So if you've had the fall today and you need care tomorrow, you probably don't have a 5-year window to be giving assets away, whether that's a house or something else. What that means on the other side of that coin, though, of course, is if I'm healthy and I'm at home and I'm 65 and I don't need care for 10 or 15 or 20 years, maybe that's the window where I'm going to start giving some stuff away, knowing that I'm going to hopefully allow that 5-year period to pass.
Where did the 5-year period come from?
It's just statute through the federal government. We've had it for a long time. Years ago, there was a 1-year look back. It became 3 for a while. It's now been 5 for close to 15 years. Every now and then, someone will ask, I've heard it's changing to like a 7-year or more. It's been 5 for a long time, but that's just a product of a federal statute that says what it is.
Okay. So with that 5-year look back, if you have a house, if you have the money, the Medicaid says use your money to pay for your care.
Absolutely. It is the same Medicaid system that we have for other types of welfare. So if you've run out of money and need help with basic shelter, food, et cetera, you can apply for food stamps, Medicaid, other types of resources. In the context of long-term care, there is Medicaid for the aged, disabled, and blind that pays for long-term care, but has the same constraints in that you need to be under their thresholds in order to qualify for the benefits.
Do you work with people on powers of attorney as well, so that, you know, who is making the decisions for these loved ones?
Absolutely. This entire conversation just sort of assumed that this person who's had this tragic fall and are going to do some planning would still be able to make decisions and talk to someone like me. The reality is it more often than not is going to involve some caretakers, perhaps a child who is appointed as their power of attorney. In Ohio, we separate that into health care and finances, and this involves both. Where are you going to stay? What facility you're going to is a healthcare decision, but how are you going to pay for that facility is financial. Ideally, in this scenario where someone's fallen, they would have said years ago, if I'm in an accident, here's my healthcare person, here's my financial person. And those people are empowered under the law to then make the important decisions to help you move the money around to pay for your care if you need them to.
What if you have a family member who's willing to help take care of you, but they have to quit their job to do it? Is mom or dad allowed to pay them, like use their own money, like kind of like
absolutely. Yeah. There are some tax ramifications to that, but whether you're just going to private pay forever, or even if you wanted to qualify for veterans or Medicaid benefits, certainly you can contract with anyone you'd like. For a lot of people, there isn't a child who's got the skill and the capacity and the willingness to care for you full time. But I've had plenty of cases where we've said, almost to keep the money in the family, we're going to hire our son or daughter or daughter-in-law or son-in-law or perhaps a combination, and they're going to provide the care. If you're signing a contract for services, you are paying that person. That person is being paid for something that is a taxable event that needs to be reported for income tax. But in the scheme of things, I've had families who've said, even if I'm paying X to my son who pays some percent in tax, that's better than paying all of X to a third party who I don't know and who I may not trust the same way I trust my family member. So it's certainly possible you can pay someone. If you're not reporting it as compensation for what they're doing for you, then perhaps there's some gifts and some way you can navigate through that as well. But you're really getting into sort of murky waters there.
Yeah, there's murkiness with the gifting, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. I guess we'll just end on, do most people that you talk to, is the goal to stay in their own home? Is that the goal that a lot of people come to you with?
Absolutely. If you ask someone, particularly before time of need, what is your goal for later in life healthcare? I'd like to live in my home as long as possible. And, you know, we're all probably hoping to pass peacefully in our sleep in our own bed someday. That's probably not going to be the reality for a lot of people. So I encourage them to plan in advance to the extent they can. But yes, that is absolutely a goal for most people.
And finally, you you mentioned earlier that you wish people would plan in advance. So a year ago yesterday, come in and see you. Is that how much in advance?
If you're trying to qualify for Medicaid, 5 years and a day would be good. If it's veterans benefits, theirs is technically a 3-year look back. So 3 years and a day. It's not too soon. Mm-hmm. While you're able to make decisions, come in and get the power of attorney, a will. Maybe you need a trust. Maybe you don't. Those things can be revised if you still have the abilities. There's no harm in having it done in advance. The crisis I run into is I did nothing. A bad thing has happened. And now how do I make the best of it? And I may have to involve court systems and more costs. And it may be harder to do than if you'd just written it in advance.
Right. That was Jeff Klunkler, the family, wealth, and estate planning attorney with Carlisle Patchen and Murphy. Thanks for joining us today, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been Untangled from All Sides in WOSU Public Media. Join us next time when we will discuss disparities in the elder care system and how we can meet the needs of underserved populations. Support for Inside Caregiving is powered by the Storytellers Trust. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News and WOSU Public Media.